This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. America is number one. The terrorists tried to topple the crown when they toppled the Twin Towers, but the United States struck back with all the awesome might and presumed rights of a superpower. But does America really want to be the world's top dog forever? It was never easy, and it got a whole lot harder post 9/11. Tonight, what it means to stay on top in the new 9/11 world. We begin the hour with more bad news from the airline industry. Faced with high-flying challenges after September 11th, American Airlines and Continental Airlines today reported record losses of nearly $1 billion in the last quarter of 2001. Rudy Maxa is a correspondent with The Savvy Traveler. I asked him if he sees profits or problems on the horizon and what he thinks are the biggest challenges or were the biggest challenges for airlines after 9/11.
The first big task was to convince people to fly again. We've certainly seen this with other airline tragedies. This was probably certainly the most dramatic of our lifetimes. And so airlines lowered fares to levels they knew would make them no money, but basically they had to convince folks to get back into the air and to overcome the horror of having seen videotapes of commercial jetliners crashing into the Pentagon, and, well, the World Trade Center, to be exact, over and over and over again. So they did that, and incrementally the traffic has come back. Month after month, there's been improvement in the number of people flying. Now the airlines have to get back into the black, which means some of the amazing bargains we've seen the last few months will begin evaporating.
Rudy, are levels back to where they would have been in a normal January in the last few years?
They are not. Now, keep in mind, January and February are the lowest travel months for airlines anyway, even the best of times. But the levels still are not back. They're probably about 15%, speaking generally, short of where they would have been, you know, say this time last January. But that's a lot better than over 20%, 22%, one-third off after September 11th.
And what's your sense, who's flying now and who's not?
Well, I think business travelers who have had to fly continue to fly, though not in as great a numbers as they were. Those numbers had already started to drop off.
We hear a lot more about conference calls and remote video conferencing.
Exactly, and advanced purchases of cheaper tickets by business travelers. And there have been a certain, it certainly has been a great time for folks looking for bargains to go overseas or fly long routes to Asia, for example. So certainly some bargain hunters have found very low fares over the last few months and will continue to for the next couple of months at least.
Do you recall any of the bargain flights that stick in your mind as historic bargains in the last few months, Rudy?
Northwest offering a deal through mid-March, I believe, where you can take 10,000 miles out of your account and put $200 on the table and fly cross-country. You can put 20,000 miles into a pot along with, say, $300 and fly from Detroit to Tokyo.
That's a pretty good distance for $300 and a few frequent flyer miles.
It's outrageous.
Where are people going? What are the popular destination spots now?
Well, close to home seems to be the catchphrase. Spas are one of the few segments of the travel industry that haven't experienced a downturn in business.
But people are flying to pamper themselves in spas. Is that it, to get over the trauma?
Right, or driving to them. They're going to some in their own neighborhood, you know.
Where aren't people flying?
Well, they certainly aren't flying to the Middle East, even though, I mean, you know, if you said, hey, let's go to Jordan tomorrow, Rudy, or to Egypt, I'd go. But the Middle East blends into one blur, I think, to many Americans, and many travelers. So, you know, England was already way off. The UK was off because of foot and mouth before September 11th. But Europe generally is down. Africa's down. I think people want to go to places they feel where they feel safe, whether they think about it consciously that way or not.
And how about those low fares? Are they going to last?
Well, they'll last if business doesn't come back. I mean, I'm guessing that by spring and by summer, barring any terrible calamities, that business will get back to normal and we'll see normal fares again.
What do you think, Rudy Maxa? Will 9/11 leave any kind of lasting mark on travel, on the travel industry?
Well, it certainly has already in terms of how we regard flying. That instead of it being At best, a wonderful escape, and at worst, a crowded experience, and flights are late because the skies are so crowded, et cetera, et cetera. That certainly all changed. Now, flying is something you take relatively seriously. You think about it. You think how far ahead you have to get to the airport and how long the security lines are for that particular airline at that particular airport. And then you think about the possibility of of terrible things happening. You can't avoid it, you know, and you know, a guy with explosives in his shoes doesn't help.
Puts a different cast on things.
It does.
Tomorrow, these new bomb screening measures go into effect at the nation's airports. You report on travel and travel all the time. What's your personal sense, Rudy Maxa, of security at airports today, and what potential problems do you see for travelers and air safety with these enhanced security measures?
Well, certainly we've never been more security conscious when flying. Having said that, I had hoped that after the loss of lives and the explosion over Lockerbie mm-hmm. and Pan Am jetliner that we would have been screening bags for explosives and that we would have been matching bags with passengers, but we didn't. And, you know, until September 11th, I never talked about it. I consciously didn't talk about mm-hmm. it on public radio mm-hmm. or anyplace else because you don't want to give, you know, some nut an idea.
Right.
But the fact was, and anybody who thought about it long would realize, that pretty much anybody could put a checked bag on board, just not get on the plane, and if there was something evil inside, evil things would happen.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very different time now. I wish I could say we were doing all that, but as we know, there aren't enough machines to check bags. And what will happen is if somebody, it certainly happened to me. I once was sitting right by a gate. I remember somewhere in the Midwest reading a novel. I was so engrossed in the novel, I missed the boarding of my flight, and it took off.
With your bag, without you.
Right. Nope. But the point of that is that people make honest mistakes.
Right.
And let's say I had been reading in an airport, like airline lounge, you know, where I didn't hear myself paged. Mm-hmm. Or I was in a, you know, a TGIF's or some chain right. Cheers bar in a restaurant.
Right.
I got roasted in a magazine. I didn't look at the time. You know, there are going to be all these people sitting on a plane while they unload all the luggage from the belly of the aircraft and have to search out my one bag because, you know, I lost.
Because you weren't on. Do you think that's going to become part of our flying experience?
It's certainly going to happen, and it'll get a lot of publicity when it does.
Rudy Maxa is correspondent for The Savvy Traveler. He spoke to us from Washington. It's going to take a lot more than patriotism and laser-guided missiles for the United States to remain number one in the world. Preserving America's place will take enormous military, economic, and diplomatic energy and skill. It's a challenge, says tonight's guest, historian Paul Kennedy, that would make even Bismarck squirm. And it raises some very interesting questions. Is being number one worth the price? Will globalization make it even harder? Would it be so bad just to be another well-off France or Germany, or is the very thought un-American? What do you think? Join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us now from Connecticut is Paul Kennedy. He's a leading light in military strategy, diplomacy, and international relations at Yale University. His essay, Maintaining America's Power from Injury and Recovery, appears in the new book, The Age of Terror. Good evening and welcome. Welcome, Paul Kennedy.
Good evening, sir.
Thanks,
good to be with you.
Good to have you. Also with us from Vermont Public Radio is Special Coverage's own news analyst, Jack Beattie, a senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Paul.
Hello, Jack. Good to hear from you.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to hear your voice.
The gang's all here. Paul Kennedy, jump right in with us. You know, the whole idea of discussing whether or not America should be number one does have a kind of un-American ring about it. It's a conversation Americans don't want to have or many believe we don't need to have. Is this a British view of living with bygone empire that you're offering here, or is this really on the table as something Americans have to think about?
No, it isn't a particularly British view. Let's go back to the source of the article on maintaining American power. And after mm-hmm. all, I'm arguing why we should do it and how we should do it. In response to September the 11th, we at Yale were thinking of various ways of considering the future.
Mm-hmm.
And there was obviously a short-term military response, which has been overwhelming, the elimination of Taliban and Al-Qaeda, etc. But the question was, if we are in an age of terror and if we were in an age of new threats and challenges, just, you know, for how many years will the American democracy want to keep doing these fire expeditions out in Afghanistan? And if we want to, will we always have the sources of power to do it? What are the long-term foundations for our quite unique position in the world as number one?
Mm.
And how do we sustain them?
Well, it's a huge question. And give us the top level, though. Just we'll dig into this. But at the top level, what will be the price of staying number one? And I guess on the other hand, what would be the price of surrendering the crown, if you will?
second part is much more difficult. I think the price right now is a fairly cheap one. We have been investing in a fantastic military all through the Cold War and 10 years after the Cold War when everybody else has been de-investing.
Mm-hmm.
So that we are now so far ahead of every other power militarily in the world. I've gone back checking historically. I don't think the British Empire at its prime or the Roman Empire comes equivalent to us. And what's more, we get by it with about 3% of gross domestic product put in our military.
Quite affordable, you're saying.
It's world number one power on the cheap. It is affordable.
And yet you say that our military, the U.S. military, is as big as the militaries of the next 9 nations combined.
The defense budget of the Pentagon is now equivalent to the defense budgets of the next 9 largest defense spending nations, which has never happened in world history.
You also point out that while the U.S. is 1/20th of the world population, it creates 1/3 of the world's production, its economic output?
Yes, and spends 40% of its defense and, you know, has 45% of its internet traffic and 75% of its Nobel Prize winners.
So when you describe it that way, it looks like we can handily afford to be number one. Why should we consider not being number one in the U.S.?
Because, first of all, we can handily consider it, and I don't think there will be any real change in the next, 15, 20, 25 years. There's not a massive challenger in sight, and if somebody comes along to frighten us by saying China or India is, mm-hmm. they're just totally wrong.
But 15 years is a blink of time in your historian's perspective. Are you saying that beyond that, things look tougher somehow?
Rousseau once quipped that if Rome and Carthage fell, which country is immortal? And the answer is none. But there's a long time out there. And the question is that I pose in my essay called The Maintenance of American Power is how do we take prudent steps to keep things in the nice position we have, the very cozy position we have?
So I guess we're going to have to dig into that and see what steps you're describing there, what steps you're offering. But
right.
Do you really think Americans are prepared to think any other way about it other than, of course you want to be number one, and that's what we're going to do, period, full stop?
No, I don't know about you and our listeners, and I'd love to hear their responses.
I'm sure we will.
I have a sense that I guess I've felt a whole number of American responses. Some of the people feel like, passionate, Nebraska University supporters that they obviously want to be number one. I meet other Americans who...
As if it's a football game, you mean?
Yeah, as if it's a football game. But I meet other Americans who would actually quite like to have this country in a quieter and, less at the top of the agenda position, less being asked to help out, less being told by Madeleine Albright that we are the indispensable power. We'd quite like a somewhat more moderated role, and that's pretty understandable to me.
Jack Beatty, there's a lot to dig into here, but just at the top level for you, do you think this is a question Americans are prepared to seriously contemplate, giving up number one, being something more like, a super Germany or very happy France, but not the hyperpower?
Well, I think just 15 years ago, and I think Paul would agree with this, there was more of a mood for that, I think. The idea was that we were, as Paul put it in an earlier book, we had an imperial overstretch, that our commitments, our military commitments, exceeded our economic strength or were sufficiently large as to endanger the foundations of our economic strength.
Mm-hmm.
But since then, of course, the Soviet Union has disappeared. Our economy, which then was declining, underwent the high-tech boom, and I think that brought a kind of unipolar feeling. I mean, it's a reality. It's a unipolar world. I think the question is how, and I think we need to go back to Paul's earlier work, how long we can keep the military commitments and the economic strength.
We're going to dig into all the underpinnings of America's number one status after a break. You can join the conversation. Does the United States have to be number one? Is it worth any price? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or join us online at WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. We'll be right back. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight with historian Paul Kennedy. He's director of international security studies at Yale University. He contributed an essay called Maintaining American Power from Injury to Recovery. It's in a new book called The Age of Terror. We're also joined by our news analyst, Jack Beatty. And the question is tonight, must America remain number one? What's going to be the price in the decades ahead of hanging on to that status? What would be the price of letting go? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Paul Kennedy, we're going to dig in to what you say is the new meaning of power and how the price of maintaining is going to change. But before we do that, I want to just touch for a minute on how the blast of 9/11 singed you a little bit in the aftermath of 9/11. You commented, and correct me because I know I'll get this wrong, but saying something to the effect that if the United States had suffered the way that the Islamic world had suffered historically, then we would also be upset. We would understand their rage. What did you mean by that, and what kind of response did you get in the American media? How did you interpret it?
Well, first of all, I try to answer a question at a public debate at Yale about, from my Yale students, about why do they seem to dislike us so much?
The question that was everywhere.
Yeah, why do they hate us so much? Mm-hmm. Why are these, you know, young people and women in the Gaza Strip running out and punching the air with joy when we are weeping and crying at our losses? And one of the reasons I suggested was that we appeared in their eyes and in their news presentations and propaganda as a, you know, the 500-pound gorilla. And if there was a united, enormous Ottoman Empire sort of country in the world which was patrolling our shores and flying over us, we might feel pretty resentful ourselves. It was an attempt at a kind of let's get in the mind. It wasn't to do with terrorism and the minds of the terrorists. It was, why are so many of those people out there across the Muslim world rejoicing at our pain?
And what did you learn from the kickback you got to those comments?
It was really mixed. There was an inordinate amount of hate mail, very much from people who just hadn't heard the second part of my remarks about the evils of religious fundamentalism. They just came in and said, you know, you are justifying terrorism. There was a lot of also supportive mail and emails saying, well, thank you for posing the question of what is our American Republic of the founding fathers and the no entangling alliances and respecting others. Why is it so disliked in that part of the world? So I got mixed reviews. You know the Chinese proverb, a man who sit in middle of road get hit by traffic going in both directions? That was me.
I don't recall Confucius on that score, but we acknowledge that you're battle-hardened in the last few months.
I've got a thicker skin.
So take us to, you say, that the meaning of power changed on 9/11. How so?
I think it changed in that we've been used through the Greatest Generation, the Second World War, the Cold War, to think of power as being something represented by national states, by their powerful militaries, by their B-1 bombers. And boy, we have seen that in spades in the past 2 months, of course. Mm-hmm. But there may be a more insidious power, what political scientists call asymmetrical power.
Of course, the weak against the strong.
And a way of using insidious methods of, you know, putting anthrax into the San Francisco train system or something like that, which we're not that well equipped to deal with.
So how is the challenge going to change? How is the price tag for the U.S. position in the world going to rise, or how is it rising now in the world?
Well, I think let me talk about the price tag. I think that we have invested to an incredible extent in our orthodox military, air, land, sea, undersea, and we have no competitors out there at all. But I think that we're going to need investments, not just physical, not just financial, but possibly also psychological and cultural, in thinking about the asymmetrical threats. We are moving at it at an incredible pace, but it's hard for me and for I guess many Europeans who've come from, you know, London or Belfast or Barcelona or Rome, to think of a United States which has to have a kind of cautionary internal worry about subversion, about terrorism, in this Norman Rockwell world we were in before September the 11th.
And you still feel that America is going to have to take on that new caution, that new suspicion? I think there's a temptation already since 9/11 to say, hey, you know what? We're doing all right.
I know that. It's psychological. You have to let your guard down. You can't be, you know, looking out of the side of your eyes all the time. It's a very natural process. The authorities are warning us that sometime in the future something else will happen.
You've got a provocative thesis in your essay, and it goes directly to globalization, which has got a lot of airing since 9/11. You say that the U.S. has been encouraging globalization on the assumption that if everyone gets better off, so will we, but it ain't necessarily so in terms of global position and strategy. What do you mean by that?
Well, most of this country, and certainly the business elite of this country, believes in globalization. I think it's the old theory about, you know, rising tide lifts all boats. But it isn't lifting all boats at the same time. We've just had an awful report from the UN Population Fund that the number of people on $1 a day in poverty will go from 2 billion to 4 billion in the next half century, and create all sorts of massive indignation and resentments. And also, this globalization means the opening up of America to all sorts of forces and trends and people and transfers at a time when there are resentments of our power and our number one sense. So it's a kind of mixed bag of cookies. It's not all favorable.
Mm-hmm. Jack Beatty, how does it look to you? We're hearing from Paul Kennedy that the price tag may rise, and we'll talk more about that, but also that even if the great globalization project comes to pass, it won't necessarily redound to the U.S. benefit.
Well, I think it's important to hear that emphasis simply because there's been a kind of uncritical celebration of globalism up until now, and I think people are suddenly saying, wait a minute, this also means the interpenetration of our society by people who from everywhere. Paul speaks of the dual aims of U.S. foreign policy looking ahead, security policy, fighting terror on the one hand and mm-hmm. keeping our other commitments on the other. And he fears what he calls cross purposes and conflicting missions. And I'm wondering, Paul, what you think of this. The postulate is that democracies don't fight one another. Now, of course, there are exceptions, but there's a book from Yale University Press by a physicist a few years ago who said nothing like that in 500 years, and he had to work his conditions with Germany. So if that's the postulate, democracies don't fight one another, and if the other postulate is terrorism does not arise under legitimate governments, this says to me, at least, that our two policies can go together, encouraging democracy in the great powers and encouraging democracy as a kind of anti-terrorism strategy. And the economic component is that, say, a China can only be envisioned as a democracy if it has the economic preconditions. And that requires not only growth, but a more equitable spreading of growth. So I'm wondering, Paul, if your dual purposes can't be yoked under the overarching purpose of encouraging democracy in the world.
Paul Kennedy, how about it?
I think that's so true. And I think that that's certainly the way, for example, someone like Colin Powell thinks. Spread of democracy, the fact that democracies don't fight each other because they've learned how to reconcile differences internally, so they know how to recognize differences externally, and the fact that democracies themselves do not want to have terrorists and do not approve of terrorist methods is a benign trend. I have to say, though, I was mischievous enough to pose a question in this essay regarding China. that supposing we do raise China, all of China, all of the 1.2 billion, in a short while, 1.4 billion Chinese up to the level of Kansas, and have exactly the same per capita gross domestic product as us.
Just sounds like a big market, Paul Kennedy.
It is a big market, but it would mean that China would be four times as big as us in world affairs.
Does that mean China would be number one?
Yes, it would be number one by a massive factor.
Ipso facto, it just necessarily means so?
Yes, if every 1.4 billion of the Chinese had an income of $33,000 like the Americans do, our 265 million Americans, what would we do? We'd be displaced by the Chinese elephant.
Well, what's the problem with that? Maybe that is the scenario where we become the happy Switzerland. Maybe we're the happy Switzerland then.
Yes. So this is for our readers, our listeners to kind of think about. If we want to raise China up to the level of Kansas, can we buy the consequence?
Listeners, we're raising China to the level of Kansas, and we're lolling back in the armchair. What do you think? Are you ready to not necessarily be number one? Maybe not tomorrow, maybe not for 15 years. Maybe your children, maybe your grandchildren. Could that work for the United States? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Terrence is on the line. Welcome, Terrence.
Thank you. A really enjoyable conversation. Before I made my point, just a funny discussion about China potentially being four times the size of the U.S. economically reminds me of the old Saturday Night Live skit where they put up a map of Russia and laugh when they put different countries in and say, oh, look at how much bigger we are. I'm not really sure that's sort of a relevant measurable. I think my point is that I almost think it's arrogant to have this discussion because the U.S. is, by its nature, more an idea than a place. In other words, we're a very diverse country, and in that diversity, I think it gives us the tendency toward having kind of a stabilizing influence in the world, and it also, in our diversity, has us with a culture that tends to be relatively competitive.
Terrence, but do you mean by that if the United States is number one, the whole world is number one, and they should all be happy?
Well, I guess so. I mean, I think that I know that sounds shallow, but
tell
I think
that to the Taliban.
We are an international microcosm ourselves, and, deploy ourselves to a somewhat competitive environment, so I don't think it is Norman Rockwell-ish at all. And in that sense, I think that much as we tend to seek stability at home, we tend to naturally do the same in the world, and it's our nature, and so I don't think it matters that we're number one. I think that our society, in terms of what makes it great, is its decentralization.
But Terrence, I don't hear Osama bin Laden singing "We Are the World" with Colin Powell.
Well, we should not have the coordinated security measures, not that we shouldn't go after terrorism, but talking about the U.S. being number one in the world is, I think, a much larger discussion than just the war on terrorism.
We'll grant you that. Let's put it to Paul Kennedy. Paul, how about it? You've looked at lots of nations, empires that have been number one. Is the whole idea of being number one now somehow, post-postmodern, outmoded?
No, I don't think it is. And Terrence, you raise a really good point. And let me make it clear that I, for one, am happy that the U.S. is number one. I'd rather the U.S. be number one than, a long list of other countries be number one. My point is that being number one over a long time may bring certain costs. And I don't mean by that financial costs. I mean attitudinal costs, revulsion in the country against always having to be the first to go into Africa or Afghanistan.
You mean we just get tired or we become bad people somehow?
Well, not only do we become hardened to it, perhaps, but we might provoke within ourselves a really serious civic debate for being number one, or please can we not pull back? There's also the question of how we are seen from the outside. We may regard ourselves as, benign, democratic, good exemplar for the world. When you talk candidly to Indians or French or Chinese or Ukrainians, there's a kind of build-up, and there will be a build-up of resentment against the 500-pound gorilla, which sometimes I worry about.
Well, that must always be there, I guess. Nicholas is on the line. Welcome, Nicholas. You're on the air.
Hey, great to be on the air. This has been a great conversation.
Good to have you.
Thank you. I guess I want to mention a sidebar before my original comment, which made me the call, which is I do think democracies in general will strengthen each other if we can keep that up.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember reading something Thomas Friedman wrote about the McDonald's principle, that, you know, if countries that both have McDonald's in their country won't fight each other.
Right, the parallel of Jack Beatty's two democracies don't fight.
Yeah. Along the original path there about us being number one and if we can even control it, I don't think we are number one anymore. And that was
What do you mean by that, Nicholas? You heard the numbers that Paul Kennedy was reeling off.
All right, well, maybe I should rephrase it. I think it's insignificant that we're number one, at least militarily speaking. I mean, it seems like now with globalization, you can have four or five military aircraft carriers out there. But we can get trumped by a 34-cent stamp now.
Mm-hmm.
And with the greatness of globalization now becomes miniaturization, which in many ways can be a threat to us that we need to recognize. If we truly want to stay number one, I think we have to much more pay attention to our backyards, like the 34-stamp, rather than uploading more aircraft carriers.
You mean homeland security or something else, Nicholas?
No, I think we should watch more in a sort of a closer-knit way. Our neighbors, our friends, get tighter family bonds. And in other words, don't rely on the military or a federal entity anymore to protect us, because I see a certain weakening
mm-hmm.
in federal entities in general,
mm-hmm.
and mainly because of technology and globalization. You know, it's sort of it's kind of like not what was our intended purpose of being so successful, but our very success, I think, has in many ways weakened us.
We've got it. We understand. And, Paul Kennedy, your essay speaks to that. We've just got a minute left before the break. But what about it? Is the elephant status itself a kind of obsolete mark of power?
No, I think Nicholas has put his finger on a very wonderful point, which is to what extent does our concern and our commitment to being number one, to being focused upon the international war against terrorism, might it compromise some of the other things that Americans are concerned about on their home front mm-hmm. and in their backyard?
Such as?
Such as education, such as improving their standards of living, such as just trying to create community. All of this can be perhaps distorted by a media blitz, which is all about, you know, turning Afghan hillsides into a dump yard.
But you point out very clearly that staying at the head of the pack means you must have education, you must have a good community network.
Yes, I do. I think that the long-term sustenance of American power, and this is what the essay in The Age of Terror is about, involves deep investments on the social fabric and on the educational fabric. And it involves deep investments in democratic discourse, such as Nicholas is raising.
Paul Kennedy, stand by. The question is, can we globalize the rest of the world successfully and still stay on top? Do we want to? Is being number one worth any price, worth bearing any burden? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight with historian Paul Kennedy of Yale's International Security Studies Operation about the number one status in the world of the United States. What's it going to cost the country to keep that status? Is it worth keeping that status? Is it important, or is it somehow now irrelevant? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Paul Kennedy, are we in la-la land even talking about whether we can hang on to this status? You've studied empires and great nations over the centuries, the millennia. No nation stays on top.
No nation stays on top. And that was, I guess, the argument in my controversial book about 12 years ago, The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers. But I have to say that with the stagnation in Japan, the kind of paralysis in Europe, and the implosion of Russia, the United States now is sitting in a very comfortable position. I'm not arguing it will go on forever, and my essay is suggesting ways we can maintain ourselves better by, as you heard before, more investments in education, the social fabric, the infrastructure, underpinnings of a country. But right now, I would say that the United States, in military and economic terms, occupies a position larger relative to other countries than we've seen in world affairs for millennia.
Listeners, if it weren't so, could you imagine Americans just being a big Germany or a rich France, a Brazil? How would you feel if China were number one? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Miles is on the line. Hello, Miles.
Hi.
Hi.
You know, it's interesting. I recently read Neil Ferguson's The Cash Nexus.
Yes, we've talked about it here on this show.
He quotes Paul Kennedy a great deal, and there is some similarity. He talks about how the recent run-up in the stock market and mm-hmm. in Western financial markets it really parallels a financial bubble, and that one of the best ways to keep that bubble up is to shift from our foreign policy from an informal form of imperialism to a formal form of imperialism.
So are you with him on that, Miles, or where do you stand?
Well, you know, I do think America should be number one, but I don't know if I agree with the way that's formulated.
Let's put it to Paul Kennedy. Paul, I'm sure you know Neil Ferguson's argument that the United States has been an informal imperial power, and it's moving into a period of formal imperial power.
Yes, Neil is now arguing that what we're going to see in the next, you know, 5, 10, 15 years is a kind of formalization of an American imperium.
That doesn't sound very American either.
It doesn't sound very American. It's totally contradictory to what the founding fathers thought they were up to. And yet we know that we've just made, through Colin Powell and through Senator Biden, what seemed to be pretty long-term commitments to ensure stabilization in Afghanistan. We're just putting a set of troops into the southern Philippines. I tried to do a survey the other day of from which parts of the globe did we send American armed forces to take out the Taliban. It's interesting that they didn't just come from American ports or American air bases. They came from Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean. They came from Yokohama. They came from South Korea, from Germany, Italy, mm-hmm. Great Britain, and various Middle East positions. We have the biggest spread of overseas bases existing at the moment. It's not formal empire in a way that Neil thinks about it and Miles, like myself, is worried about it. But boy, we are all over the globe. There's not many places we aren't.
It's certainly the form of it. But Jack Beatty, I don't know about you, this word imperialism keeps coming up even on this show, and I'm a little tired of hearing about it without the kind of democratic element attached to it that you raised earlier in the hour.
Well, I think it goes in the opposite direction. For example, the cost of maintaining our presence in Saudi Arabia, we've had arguments again and again on this show, is in fact to discourage the setting up of a legitimate government there. So there's a case where our military commitments are getting into the way of our long-range strategic necessity of encouraging legitimate governments such that we don't have to fear terrorists coming from them. And so, this imperial role is very frightening because it seems to assume that the 20th century didn't happen. This is a century of nationalism and of anti-colonialism, and it isn't as if that's all going to be repealed and people are just going to say, oh, all right, we'll settle for a kind of limited sovereignty with you stepping in.
You can be
those
the boss.
Those days are gone.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm?
You can be the
those
boss.
Days,
we don't hear
yeah,
that.
That's yesterday, mm-hmm. and history doesn't just repeal things because we have new problems. The old realities remain. People want to rule themselves.
Tom is on the line. Welcome, Tom. You're on the air.
Good evening. Very interesting show, gentlemen. Thank you.
Thank you.
2 points. Number one, I am of two minds on this whole subject. Mm-hmm. The United States has no business being the world's policeman. That's certainly not what the founding fathers envisioned.
But just heard Paul Kennedy describe how our troops are everywhere.
Right. However, power abhors a vacuum. And if we're not, somebody else will be. And there is no alternative to globalization. Certainly, while all the rising tide may not lift all boats at the same time, globalization has the best opportunity for rising boats of any order. Certainly, the world has a lot to learn from the United States. If they were to adopt our economic systems, the world would be a lot better off. But unfortunately, there are a lot of backward countries in the world that don't recognize the superiority of free market capitalism, and that accounts for their poverty. And there are a lot of elite groups in the world that want to blame the United States for, rather than their own idiotic economic systems, for the poverty of their people.
Mm. Tom, maybe we'd rather be model than boss. But Paul Kennedy, Tom raises the issue of power abhorring a vacuum. We've talked about China a little here, but paint a picture for us, if you would, of your view. Because if ultimately China would surpass the United States in power, what would the world look like? How would that feel to Americans to be, let's say, number two?
Well, first of all, I like Tom's raising the question of power vacuums, because I think that a number of these are likely to occur in parts of the world in the next 10 years as other societies kind of implode under internal pressures, and we're going to be asked time and again to take the lead or give the support. So we ought to be bracing ourselves mentally for that. But as to power changes, which I think is what you're asking about in regard to China, I think this will be perhaps one of the biggest, not just political, but psychological issues facing the United States. Now, I'm not one of those who automatically assume that China is just going to rise and rise and rise. I think it has incredible domestic, political, environmental, and other challenges. It may go into a civil war in 10 years' time. So I'm not...
There's nothing inevitable. But if it should, what would it feel like?
But if it should, then if it's a democratic China and a benign China and a terrific market China, which is, you know, sucked in Bechtel and Boeing even more and more and more, we might find it easier to deal with in the way, I mean, go back to the late 19th century, where the number one power, Great Britain, was being challenged by the United States, a democracy on the one hand, and by Imperial Germany under Wilhelm II, a more autocratic regime, on the other. The British found it much easier to engage in a kind of compromise and appeasement with the rise of American power, and they reacted bristlingly and eventually going to war with the rise of German power. So the issue is, you know, what sort of China would we be willing to relate to as its power increased relative to ours?
So it's only a hypothetical, but you paint two starkly different paths there. One, as we know, it led to war in the British example that you give, and the other to a long-standing warm relationship. Paul Kennedy, thanks for painting the whole mural for us this evening. We're very grateful to you for coming on.
Great to be on the show. Hi.
I and by.
Thanks, Paul.
Paul Kennedy is professor of history at Yale University and director of the International Security Studies Program there. His recent essay, Maintaining American Power from Injury to Recovery, appears in the new book, The Age of Terror. Jack Beatty, this number one thing feels like a yoke and also the power that it is all at once.
Yeah, we're not in Kansas anymore, are we?
No, we're not.
Getting the world to Kansas is a mixed bag. On the one hand, it'll mean more prosperity and decency. On the other hand, a threat to our status as number one.
And a lot of people asking, hey, what are you doing on top anyway?
Yeah.
Jack Beatty, thanks much for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. This week, many Americans were glued to Ken Burns' documentary on the life of Mark Twain. McAvoy Lane lives in Incline Village, Nevada. He's been performing all over the world as the humorist from Hannibal, Missouri, for 14 years. Tonight, he shares passages from Mark Twain's 1909 work, Letters from the Earth, passages he says resonate in a post-September 11th world.
In truth, man is incurably foolish. Simple things, which the other animals easily learn. He is incapable of learning. Among my experiments was this. In an hour, I taught a cat and a dog to be friends. I put them in a cage. In another hour, I taught them to be friends with a rabbit. In the course of 2 days, I was able to add a fox, goose, squirrel, and some doves. Finally, a monkey. They live together in peace, even affectionately. Then, in another cage, I confined an Irish Catholic from Tipperary. And as soon as he seemed tame, I added a Scotch Presbyterian from Aberdeen. Next, a Turk from Constantinople, a Greek Christian from Crete, an Armenian, a Methodist from the wilds of Arkansas, a Buddhist from China, and finally a Salvation Army colonel from Wapping. Then I stayed away 2 whole days. When I came back to note results, the cage of higher animals was all right. In the other was but a chaos of gory odds and ends, of turbans and fezes and plaids and bones and flesh. Not a specimen left alive. These reasoning animals disagreed on a theological detail and carried the matter to a higher court. Now, heaven goes by favor. If it went by merit, you would stay out and your dog would go in. There never was a nation that put its whole trust in God. I think it would better read, within certain judicious limitations, we put our faith in God. And if there is not enough room on the coin, well, enlarge the coin. The ordinary reverence, the reverence defined and explained by the dictionary, costs nothing. Reverence for one's own sacred things, parents, religion, flag, laws, and respect for one's own beliefs, these come natural to us. They are involuntary, like breathing. There is no personal merit in breathing. But the reverence which is difficult and which has personal merit in it is the respect which you pay without compulsion to the political and religious attitude of a man whose beliefs are not yours. You can't revere his gods or his politics, and no one expects that of you. But you could respect his belief in them if you tried hard enough. But it is very, very difficult, next to impossible. So we hardly ever try. If the man doesn't believe as we do, we say he is a crank, and that settles it. It does nowadays, because now we can't burn him. Where the temperament is two-thirds happy or two-thirds unhappy, no political or religious beliefs can change the proportions. It is easy to find fault if one has that disposition. There once was a man who, not being able to find any other fault with his coal, complained that there were too many prehistoric toads in it.
The words of Mark Twain, as selected and performed by Twain scholar McAvoy Lane. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston.